Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guests this half hour were recent guests of the Greater Des Moines Council on Foreign Relations. They spoke about how climate change and energy policy impact a number of very important things: military capability and economic competitiveness, as well as international trade and diplomacy. Joe Bryan and John Morton are both senior fellows at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center. The Atlantic Council is a nonpartisan organization that focuses on U.S. leadership and engagement in the world to shape solutions to global challenges. I want to welcome Joe Bryan and John Morton to our program.
Thanks. Great to be here, Ben.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
Since we don't know, most of us, a lot about the Atlantic Council and about the two of you, start off, I wonder if you could start off by telling us briefly about a little bit about your backgrounds, how you came to the Atlantic Council, and more about the mission of the Atlantic Council.
Great. So this is John Morton speaking, and pleasure to be with you today, Ben, and your guests as well. The Atlantic Council, as you mentioned, is a nonpartisan think tank based out of Washington, D.C., and we work on a broad range of issues from national security issues to cybersecurity issues to energy issues to foreign policy issues. As the name suggests, the council originally focused on transatlantic issues, largely kind of European and U.S. issues, but over the last many years has extended and expanded its reach into a whole suite of more global issues. Joe and I, as you said, are affiliated with the Global Energy Center, and we focus on the question of U.S. competitiveness, preparedness, and posture in the very rapidly changing energy landscape that not only the U.S. finds itself in, but that the world finds itself in. Mm. We bring a climate lens, if you will, to that conversation, and Joe really focuses on the national security and defense implications of climate change and the energy transition, and I focus on the economic implications for the U.S. Of this very rapidly changing energy and climate world that we find ourselves in.
Okay, let's start off by having you deliver the messages you brought to the Greater Des Moines Council on Foreign Relations recently. Let's start off with military. Joe, I guess that's your wheelhouse. How does climate change and energy policy impact our military capability?
Sure. Well, thanks, Ben. Just to give you a little background on me, I come to the Atlantic Council as a senior fellow, having served in the executive branch at the Department of the Navy as Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Energy, and in that role was responsible for sort of the Navy's posture with respect to energy supplies to both our military installations here in the United States and abroad, and also to our operational platforms, our ships and airplanes and forces deployed around the world. So my perspective on the energy transition and on the role of climate and the impacts on our military capabilities come through that lens. Mm-hmm. And so what I'd say is sort of twofold. Is one of the interesting things I think we see right now is a convergence of interests around the transition. And what I mean by that is that clearly there's change happening globally in the energy sector with respect to a transition to renewables, a more efficient energy system, cost competitiveness of technologies that were previously not competitive. And John's going to talk a lot about the implications of that for business and the opportunities there are for the United States economy. But the interesting thing is those changes also serve well the military's interest, at least on the energy transition. Coming out of Iraq in 2004, then General Jim Mattis, later Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, famously said, unleash us from the tether of fuel. And what he meant by that was that there was some concern that our advance was slowed by the logistics support, by the trucks that had to bring fuel and water to our forces, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing he was worried about was that running logistics support to support the force was really dangerous. And there was a study done by the Marine Corps in about 2013 that said one Marine was killed or wounded for every 50 fuel and water convoys in Afghanistan. And so energy efficiency, having a more efficient force, more efficient platforms, renewable energy, deployed solar panels, for example, can help take fuel trucks off the road and to help allow us to do allow the military to do their job without as much dependency on logistics support and all the risks that incurs. So that's for our operational forces.
Uh-huh.
The same is true here in the United States and at our military bases, well, here in the United States and abroad, in that, you know, one of the big concerns with our military installations is their ability to stay up and running and to support critical missions, even when the commercial grid goes down, because we're very, very dependent on the commercial grid. And emerging technologies, efficiency, distributed generation, storage, all of those technologies can help keep our missions up and running and continue to allow the military to continue to do their job, even if we lose power to the grid. And we can talk maybe later about some of the risks that we're faced with respect to the grid, not the least of which is the climate risk that faces the grid, and then in turn creates national security risk because of its impact on our forces, on our military bases.
Mm-hmm. Joe, that's interesting because I've heard in passing from people talk about a so-called green military in a disparaging way, and perhaps you have as well, as if a green military is something less than, in terms of potency, effectiveness on the world stage, is something less than we would have now. And what you're telling me is that in no way a green military, if that's what we want to call it, is less effective.
Well, what I would start with is to say that what's important about what's happening right now is that the benefits of distributed generation, of renewables, of storage, the environmental benefits are all obvious and there. But for the military, it's about mission. And their job is not necessarily to be green. Their job is to get the job done to fight and win America's wars. So we need to give them the best tools to be able to do their job. And the reality is that some of the best tools now happen to be energy efficiency, distributed generation, and storage. So I think I wouldn't talk about it in terms of the green military. What I would talk about is a more effective, more mission-focused, well, always mission-focused, but technologies and changes that are going to support the military mission. And so I think it's important to just say there's an alignment here. It doesn't necessarily mean that the military has to be looking to be green, they have to be looking to be effective. And these technologies and these changes we're seeing can help them be effective.
Mm-hmm. John Morton, let's pivot over to you as someone who can talk about how climate change and energy policy impacts business and international commerce. What do you have to say about that?
Well, sure. And just by way of introduction, I come at this from I served for 7 years in the Obama administration as well as the chief operating officer of a large agency called the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which was responsible for supporting U.S. business investment in fast-growing emerging markets around the world. Mm-hmm. And then I ended my time at the White House, where I was President Obama's senior advisor on energy and climate change. Before my time in government, however, I was in the private equity business and in the private sector for a long time, and I've always been interested at the business opportunities that lie at the intersection of what I call energy, environment, and the economy. So where can you accomplish strong environmental benefits in the energy sector while making money? And I think when we hit that trifecta, right, that's a win-win-win. And I think the good news story here is that we are in a position increasingly in a situation with the cost of the underlying technologies that we have at our disposal to fight climate change, where there is a very strong economic argument to be made for more aggressive action as opposed to less aggressive action. And what I would say is that I like to refer to this transition to a global low-carbon economy as the most predictable and consequential economic transformation, perhaps in human history. And that sounds rather, you know, large and grandiose, but I think it's really true if you look at what's happening out there today. So predictable and consequential, right? We know that the world is rapidly shifting to a low-carbon economy. How do we know that? Well, we know that since 2015, there's been more renewable energy added every year to the global grid than fossil fuel energy. That's a surprising statistic for most people who tend to think of renewables as a small part of our overall, of the global energy supply.
Right.
We are now adding more renewables every year than we are fossil fuels. So that's a pretty important indicator.
And that's our country or that's international? That's all countries?
That's both. The U.S. is adding far more renewables than fossil, and globally it's about 60% renewables. And again, that's pretty interesting, right? Most people think if you look at polls, most people think renewables are about 10% of new energy. So we're well past the majority. Another indicator of this transition and how fast it's moving. You know, 40% of the world's population today now live in countries that have set a date specific for banning the internal combustion engine. So just think about that for a second, right? 4 in 10 people around the world live in countries that have said by a certain date in the not so distant future, the internal combustion engine will no longer be allowed to be sold in our country. That's amazing.
And that's primarily Western Europe.
Well, no, it's Western Europe. It's China. It's India. Right? Mm. I mean, it's big countries. It's the largest automakers and auto markets in the world.
Uh-huh.
And so if you're an automaker thinking forward, right, where are you going to be investing your R&D? Where are you going to be investing your hard-earned innovation dollars? There was a big announcement this morning that BMW that Daimler is going to be no longer producing internal combustion cars in the very, very near future. So these are the German automakers that are now beginning to transition as well. Mm-hmm. So I think what I guess my point here is that this transition to a global low-carbon economy is both predictable and consequential because if the U.S. doesn't get ahead of this and doesn't see this as not just a climate challenge, but as an economic opportunity, we run the risk of being left behind in very, very, very important technologies that are going to be the basis of the economy for the next 40 to 50 years.
Okay, so how do you size up, John, where we are right now in terms of seeing it less as a drag than as an opportunity?
Well, how do I size up where the U.S. is specifically?
Yes,
I'll give you a couple of statistics. So if you look at the 10 largest solar manufacturers in the world, one is a U.S. company, and it's the 10th largest. If you look at the 10 largest wind companies in the world, one is a U.S. Producer. If you look at the electric vehicle market, China is running away with the market in terms of number of vehicles produced annually and the size of the market. If you look at the battery market, and this is one that I think should really give us concern, the battery market, right, which will serve all sectors. It will serve the wind market. It will serve the solar market. It will serve the oil and gas market, you know, backup power generation, and it will certainly serve the electric vehicle market. Two-thirds of the lithium-ion manufacturing capacity in the world right now is in China. The supply chains that provide the minerals and the rare earth minerals that go into lithium-ion batteries are largely dominated by Chinese companies at the moment. So, you know, the U.S. is, I would argue, has not really seized the mantle of leadership on what is, again, to my mind, a very predictable and consequential transition. I think we've allowed politics to play into this too much as opposed to recognizing the economic imperative of U.S. leadership on these underlying technologies.
I want to interrupt in just a moment to remind any listeners that have just joined us that I'm talking today with John Morton, you just heard there, and Joe Bryan. They are both senior fellows with the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center, recent guests of the Greater Des Moines Council on Foreign Relations. And as you're hearing, Joe Bryan, they have significant backgrounds also in Washington with previous administrations. Joe with a real expertise in the military area, John, international business, and we're getting their messages about how climate change, energy policy impact a number of very important things in the present and increasingly in the future, military capability, economic competitiveness, international trade, and diplomacy. Let's talk a little bit about, John, about what you just mentioned there. Go into it a little bit more, both you and Brian, because what I hear you're saying is that in a lot of ways we are charging forward with renewable energy, with a better energy policy for the future, also tackling climate change. But it seems like it's not aligned with our current federal policy here. Talk about that a little bit, Joe, from your perspective. What are we seeing in terms of how policy, the current policy in this administration, matches or doesn't match the aspirations you think we should have here?
Sure. Well, a couple things. I think one of the most obvious things that's happened with the current administration is, and the thing that's been reported on quite widely, is the decision to walk away from the Paris Accord. And John can get into the details of that. Obviously, that not only affects our posture on climate, but when you think about it in terms of our national security and our diplomatic position in the world and our ability to influence events globally, that decision also alienated some key allies, right? What's important to our friends, we were telling them, is not important to us. And that's, I think, a problem. Two, it created a leadership vacuum and an opening for our competitors to step in and fill that vacuum. And I think the decision to walk away from Paris was unwise for a lot of reasons, and those two are at the top of the list. In terms of energy policy, I think our priorities are oftentimes reflected in where we put our money. And, you know, the president's most recent budget proposed cutting the Department of Energy's energy efficiency and renewable energy programs by about 75% and zeroing out investments in our RPE, which is our Advanced Research Energy Research Agency. Fortunately, Congress, and this is members of both parties, right? This is a bipartisan effort, restored that funding. But given the global competition that's underway in these markets, and China is spending, China and Europe are spending a tremendous amount of money on these technologies, I think it's incredibly unproductive for us to be arguing internally about what are essentially marginal issues, while the rest of the world is kind of full speed ahead. And as we do that, things are realigning around the world. And I'll just give you one example of a recent agreement that was forged between a Chinese company and a German company. China, Germany, BMW, and a Chinese battery manufacturer, CATL, reached an agreement where BMW will purchase, I think it's $4.7 billion in batteries from CATL. And in exchange, CATL will be building a battery manufacturing facility in East Germany. Now, we should be part of those discussions. Those should be our deals, I believe. And that's concerning, one, from an economic standpoint. It also is concerning from a geopolitical standpoint, in that there's a realignment that could potentially be going on right now, which is not in our long-term interests. Mm-hmm. Creating commercial relationships between countries are allowing that to happen without us even competing. And that's, I don't think that's necessarily a good place for us to be in the long term.
John, over to you on this point here. I mean, what Joe has just outlined is that the U.S. is an outlier here in the global community among our allies and also among our competitors. From your perspective, do you see it the same way that, well, in shorthand, that we're in danger of having someone eat our lunch?
Well, so the answer is yes. I do believe that at the federal level, very clearly. From my experience in government, working in the last administration, climate change was a top priority for the last president. And as his senior staffer on this matter for international issues, it was not a it was not a secondary or tertiary issue in bilateral meetings with other heads of state. It was a primary issue. It was at the top of the agenda. And what that meant was that, to Joe's last point, for an issue that is globally significant and meaningful to countries around the world, it was important from a diplomatic engagement standpoint to have a U.S. president who understood that, who recognized that, and who was part of pushing for more ambitious action on climate change. And I think when you step back from that posture and you take a very adversarial view on climate change, a very contrarian view, you harm your diplomatic relationships, and it complicates your ability to get other things that you want, right? Because diplomacy is about giving and taking. So yes, I believe that. Now, there's a good news part of this story as well, which is that, states, local levels, and U.S. businesses have in many ways really rallied over the last several years, and in some ways have reacted in a galvanizing way with actions and statements that show that they recognize that the transition to a low carbon economy is ongoing and that they want to be part of that.
Right. Give us some examples of local action that is surpassing or out in front of the federal action, which is, we had a president who campaigned on bringing back the coal industry, a climate change skeptic, to say the least. He called it a Chinese hoax. How are our local entities, our states and cities, advancing this agenda?
Well, the answer is they're doing it quite significantly, and states across the country are have recommitted themselves to very 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 ambitious climate targets, both because they think it's the right thing to do from a global citizenship standpoint, but also because, as I said before, they see it as the right thing to do from an economics perspective, and they see that the job bases that can be created in this transition are larger than holding on to a slowly declining but inevitably declining set of industries from the 20th century. So if you look across the country, whether it's in New York or in California or in the Pacific Northwest or increasingly in the Mid-Atlantic region and New England, look, Iowa's a great example. 10 years ago, you folks had a very nascent wind industry. Right now, you've got somewhere between 35% and 39% of your power comes from wind. And that's not because you all became environmentalists overnight. It's because it's in a cost-effective way of meeting the energy needs of Iowans. And that was during a time where the cost of producing wind turbines was much higher than it is now.
John, I want to break in here. We have to take a short break. We'll come back with our discussion. And I want to pick up, I'm glad you went to Iowa-specific information, because that's exactly where I wanted to go. John Morton, Joe Bryan, my guests this hour, both senior fellows at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center, recent guests at the Greater Des Moines Council on Foreign Relations. We'll be back with Joe Bryan and John Morton in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th. Spectators can find event info such as start times, race routes, and where to watch, as well as volunteer opportunities at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guests this hour, John Morton and Joe Bryan, senior fellows with the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center, and they were recent guests of the Greater Des Moines Council on Foreign Relations, talking about some fascinating aspects of how climate change, how energy policy impact a number of very important things: military capability, economic competitiveness, also diplomacy and international trade. Joe Bryan and John Morton in our studio in Des Moines. Let's pick up, if we could, with where we left off. I want to talk about a number of things, but when we ran out of time in the last segment, we were talking more about Iowa. Talk more about your view on how Iowa in particular fits into this picture, as you started to point out there, as one of the country's leaders in wind energy, in other renewable energy.
Well, I think Iowa is a great example of how quickly a transition can occur and has occurred, and how it happens almost without almost without noticing. Now, of course, that's an overstatement, right? I'm sure people notice what's happening out here. But in the span of a decade, coal consumption in Iowa has fallen from 78% of your electricity mix down to about 45%, and that decrease has been basically entirely made up by wind production, and that's in one decade. We've seen a 30% decrease in coal and a 30% increase in wind, and that's really driven by, as I said before, economics. And I think if you look forward and if you accept the notion that we're not moving back on this transition to a low carbon economy, if anything, the next 10 years are going to see faster movements toward a low carbon economy. Why? Because it makes sense, because it's cheaper, because the underlying technologies are cost effective, and they make sense not just from an environmental perspective, from a human health perspective, from a moral and social perspective, but now from an economic perspective. You have to look forward and think, how do we look at the carbon intensity of our economy, from our production facilities to our agricultural processing facilities, and how do we think about decarbonizing those sectors over the next 10 years? Because that's what's coming at us, right? We know that the efficiencies that are going to be squeezed out of industry after industry over the next 10 to 15 years are going to put a premium on cleaning up our act. And that's both where we have to be focused, I think, as policymakers and as innovators, but also as business leaders. And I'll just say this: what's been one of the most, I think, impressive things coming out of the last 3 years of the federal government backing away from a leadership posture on climate change has been the way the business community has moved in to fill that void. So there's something called the We Are Still In Coalition, which basically means we are still in the Paris Agreement. We are still committed to aggressive action on climate change. And that organization now is 4,000 entities strong, with 2,000 businesses that have said, we are not backing away from our climate commitments. We're, in fact, redoubling our commitments. We're moving forward and faster on them. And that's a sign that I think the business community recognizes the economic opportunities embedded in this transition to a low-carbon economy.
Joe Bryan, I wanted to turn to you to have you explain a little bit more of what you mentioned in the last half hour about threats to our grid, to our power supplies here. In the last few days, we've had in California, we've had power suppliers shut down intentionally because they wanted to prevent forest fires breaking out in California. What are the threats to our grid that are connected with climate change and other energy policy?
Well, thanks, Ben. Before I get to that, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, when I'm in Iowa, that the very productive role that Governor Vilsack played with my former boss, Secretary of the Navy Ray Mabus, in an advanced biofuel program in which we were able to support the kind of domestic growth of an advanced biofuel industry that ended up fueling a bunch of Navy ships that have deployed off the West Coast. So we've had some productive advances in biofuels, and I think that feeds into a larger demand signal that's going to come, particularly from Europe, for low carbon fuels. And so I think there was some real progress made there during the last couple of years.
The Vilsack administration here in Iowa is a bit in our past. Yeah. What about the administrations here in Iowa since then? The current administration under Kim Reynolds.
That's a bit outside my expertise, Ben. But what I'll say, in going back to your previous question about threats to the grid, maybe that's a good that's a good segue for me. The challenge facing the grid right now, and I think it's important to start with the understanding that our military installations and the missions they support, like real-time combat support in places like Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, all of those rely on the commercial grid. And in fact, a lot of our emergency response and critical infrastructure domestically, our hospitals, our police, our fire, our wastewater treatment facilities, all of those rely on the grid to stay up and running and provide those services, particularly in times of crisis. And the fact is that the grid is under threat. And there's two threats in particular. One is cyber, and the other is climate. And to just give you a sense of the cyber threat, last March, the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI issued what I think anyone would consider an unprecedented warning. And that is that the Russian government had targeted the U.S. grid and our nuclear sector in cyberspace. Now, that's not a hypothetical threat. That's a real threat, because if anyone who reads the news knows that over the past 3 years, the Russians have managed to turn off the power and turn off the lights in Kiev. And so not only have they shown an ability to use cyber to impact electricity grids globally, they've showed an intent to do it when it served their interests. So I think that's concerning. The second is climate. And I like to think of climate in impacts on military in two ways. One, it's creating a demand for new missions, right? And two, it's actually reducing and impacting our ability to support those missions. So new missions. We have a melting Arctic, which is giving rise to activity by the Russians, Chinese, all kinds of actors to exploit resources and to use it for transit, and that's only going to grow in the future. Well, the U.S. is going to have to respond to that change. And that's going to require us to invest in new capabilities, military capabilities and other, and to deploy forces to go and not necessarily fight wars, but to be present, because that's an area that we don't want to ignore. So new missions. Think about hurricane relief and disaster response. We rely on the military to help out when natural disasters hit. You just think about hurricane seasons, right? In Puerto Rico, it was the military that cleared the roads and opened the ports and delivered something like 87 million meals and 10 million liters of water so that people could get back on their feet. So we rely on the military a lot to do those things. And then when you talk about our ability to respond when those threats, whether they be national security or disaster or natural disaster, our ability to respond is based in our military installations and the platforms we house there. And you think about the last few hurricane seasons. We saw Tyndall Air Force Base take a tremendous hit. The cost to repair Tyndall is something like $5.86 billion. Camp Lejeune, a Marine Corps base in North Carolina, about $2.8 billion to repair the damage done, hurricane damage done to Lejeune. And then finally, just across the border from Iowa into Nebraska, the Offutt Air Force Base, which floods early this year, damaged about 30 buildings, and that's the home of U.S. Strategic Command. So climate is creating new missions, new demands, and at the same time, it's impacting our ability to actually respond to those demands.
Mm-hmm. And with the extreme weather, we've had discussions, many on this program, about the more and more extreme weather predicted for the Midwest, given climate change. Your examples are right to the point there. Let me remind our listeners, Joe Bryan and John Morton, my guests this hour, senior fellows with the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center. Let's talk a little bit more about an aspect of your recent talk in Des Moines, international trade. Of course, Iowa, very dependent on international trade with our ag exports, also our manufacturing exports as well. How does climate change and energy policy figure into international trade?
Well, in many ways, direct and indirect. So, you know, indirectly, as we were speaking about before, if the U.S. is seen as an unreliable partner on the issue of climate change as a whole, it complicates our ability to negotiate the trade deals that we would like to have that benefit the U.S. Producers and consumers the most. So I do think there's a challenge we have when we step back from the table and take a very adversarial position on a key policy priority like climate change. It complicates our ability to get other things done.
It has a ripple effect.
It certainly has a ripple effect. And it has had a ripple effect quite clearly. You know, I lived in Europe for the last couple of years. I just moved back from Germany from several years living there. And I can tell you that the U.S., the federal posture on climate change has a direct impact on how the Germans and how the Europeans think about the United States and what they are willing to do for the United States in return, as diplomatic partners. So that's one indirect but quite tangible impact, I think, of the U.S. posture on climate change. In a more direct sense, look, you know, the world is going to look different in 20, 30 years than it does today. We know the world that we know that the temperatures are rising. We know the impacts that are happening now with respect to extreme weather events and increasing frequency of droughts and floods, et cetera. That will have an impact on production. So the question isn't whether that's going to happen. The question is how fast and how are we going to respond? How do we get ahead of that? And this is where I try to take a slightly more optimistic perspective than many, because I think we have to be optimists. We have to tackle this challenge head on. You know, the New Climate Economy, which is an organization based out of Washington, puts out a report where they quantify the business opportunities embedded in this transition. And they say that it's about a $26 trillion opportunity between now and 2030 for the world to lean into the transition to a global low-carbon economy, as opposed to waiting for things to happen to us. In other words, the market opportunities are much bigger if we see this as a market opportunity and a challenge, as opposed to sitting back and letting our ports be swamped, okay, letting our military installations be swamped, and letting our food production and farmlands be swamped.
It sounds so logical when you say it there, John, but there are forces and strong arguments against this. What do you encounter as the biggest, as the arguments you have to counter again and again when you say, let's look at this as an opportunity, not as a drag on where we want to stay, but on an opportunity, as an opportunity of where we want to be in the future, as a business opportunity, as a military opportunity?
Well, I think you have to point out the facts in terms of where we already are. And I think most people, for example, certainly in this country, and I think globally, don't understand just how quickly and positively things have already changed. So the fact, for example, that we now install more renewable energy globally around the world than we do fossil fuel, that's a pretty striking statistic. I don't think most people know that. I don't think most people know that, you know, that 40% of the world's population now lives in countries that have set a date certain for banning the internal combustion engine. I don't think most people know that the costs of solar, wind, battery storage have fallen 80% over the last decade. And so I don't think people understand just how quickly the transition is in fact happening. And that's a good thing from the perspective of the world is changing. It's a bad thing because I think we're kind of stuck a little bit in a yesteryear mindset. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is I think we need to point out the inevitability of this challenge, of this transition. And if you accept the notion that A, climate change is happening, and B, that there are that policy to combat climate change is not going to be weakened over the next 10 years globally, but it's going to be strengthened, right? There's no scenario in which the world is going to stop caring about climate change over the next 10 years. If anything, we're going to care a lot more about it because it's going to start affecting us in much more tangible ways. So if you accept that notion, which I think we have to, then you accept this idea, this premise that we have to start getting on this innovation train. We have to start using the American ingenuity and venture capital sector and banking sector for good, as opposed to investing in 20th century technologies. Mm-hmm. We have to harness our energies and deploy them for 21st century solutions to this amazing challenge, but also this amazing opportunity.
In listening to the both of you talk, John Morton and Joe Bryan, I wonder, it occurs to me to ask you, how much is this mobilizing to address climate change, which is coming, no doubt about it? How much of this, the challenge of mobilizing for this, is like mobilizing for a huge warlike threat, say the Second World War, when the world had to face down fascism and the Axis powers?
So I think it's the comparison has been made, right? And you certainly hear Democratic candidates speaking about things like a Green New Deal and a national mobilization campaign around that. And I certainly think there are parallels. I mean, I certainly think that the challenge of this moment is comparative in size to what we faced. However, I think that there's a big however there, which is that the economic opportunities of seizing the mantle of leadership on climate change, I think, are much, much, much more apparent. And so if you're a U.S. auto manufacturer, if you're a U.S. energy company, if you're a U.S. innovator and entrepreneur, you should see this as again a predictable and consequential moment to begin investing in alternatives to our current production, regimes and strategies. And I think that that's the difference, which is that this is a moment that poses an extraordinary challenge, but it also puts in front of us an economic opportunity that is both huge and entirely predictable. And we will miss out, if we don't start moving quickly, because other countries are moving quickly. They're deploying much faster than we are. And they're not doing it because they're tree-hugging liberal environmentalists. They're doing it because they see the economic opportunity in this transition.
And Ben, just to build on what John said, I think it's a really important point in that agendas are aligned here. There's not a you don't have to be an environmentalist to care that the military should stay up and running if we get cyber attacked by the Russians or by anyone else for that mm-hmm. matter. Mm-hmm. And the opportunities at this point in history for technology, which happens to be low carbon technology, to help us be more resilient, to help us be more effective, to help the military do its job better, well, those are just aligned. It's similar to the economic opportunity. There are benefits. If you just want to focus on making sure the military can do their job, then you ought to be looking at these technologies. If you just want to focus on making money, then you ought to be focused on this opportunity. If you care about the environment and climate is your issue, then you ought to be focused on this opportunity. And so there's alignment across a number of different communities, which don't always talk to each other very well, to actually move out and get something done here. So I think that's the real positive thing that's happening right now. We don't want to be all doom and gloom about this. There right. are tremendous opportunities and alignment of interests, which transcend some of the political divides, which we see sometimes driving this debate.
And as you both mentioned beforehand, to be aware of the global political context, the context of what's happening outside of the United States and where the U.S. finds itself in this context.
That's right. And the rest of the world is not sitting back and slow walking on their response to climate change.
But we are in many ways.
I think we are at the federal level. I think at the state, local, and indeed the corporate level, I think we are moving forward. And again, in ways that are quite positive and quite promising. The thing that's lacking now and the thing that can't be underestimated or understated is the power of the federal government to set the tone and to chart the course and to put in place the certainty of policy and regulatory directional signals that will give confidence to investors and to businesses that this is where we're going, period, full stop. And you see that alignment much, much more clearly in other countries that are aligning their future production, that are aligning their future innovation, their R&D budgets around a transition to a low carbon economy. Mm-hmm. We're not yet doing that at the federal level. And therefore, we are losing time, we are losing years, and we are ultimately going to lose jobs because of that.
Okay.
Period, full stop.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple minutes left. I wanted to end on what the two of you feel an individual can do. And you have the ears of Iowans here on Iowa Public Radio, Iowans who are just a few months away from the caucuses. And I know that the Atlantic Council is a nonpartisan organization. But I guess what is the shout out in terms of individual action here? Perhaps what specific questions would you be asking candidates?
Well, what I would say, to the former, I think we could do a better job of listening to each other. I think that climate and clean energy in some ways have become a proxy for where you stand on the political spectrum. And I think that's not only unproductive, I think it's counterproductive. And I think we could do a better job of seeing the kind of alignment we've described here. And pushing forward to make these things happen because for whatever reasons appeal to you as an individual, but seeing that maybe your neighbor doesn't care as much as you do about the climate, but they care a lot about military capability, as we all do, or they care a lot about economic growth, as we all do, and to see that alignment as an opportunity to agree on something. And so I think in this current political debate, whether it's a Democratic primary, whether it's a general election, whether it's a Republican primary, I think there's too much commonality here, too much common interest, too much alignment to ignore. And I would just think it'd be a good suggestion to just look beyond whatever political labels we tend to place on ourselves and look across the country and see that we all have quite a lot in common on this issue.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. We've run out of time for this hour. Joe Bryan and John Morton, senior fellows at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center, recent guests of the Greater Des Moines Council on Foreign Relations.
That conversation recorded earlier this week. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.